Hello there. Today's Friday, February 21st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, longtime Trump associate has been sentenced in federal court. An update on the coronavirus.
That's where we believe in Africa and other continents where we have weaker health systems, the virus could be a serious danger.
Also ahead, Lizzo's latest fashion statement. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, President Trump's longtime friend and political associate Roger Stone was sentenced in court Thursday to 40 months in federal prison following an extraordinary move by Attorney General William Barr to back off his Justice Department's original sentencing recommendation. U.S. District Court Judge Amy Berman Jackson said Stone's crimes demanded a significant time behind bars, but she said the 7 to 9 years originally recommended were excessive. Stone's lawyers had asked for a sentence of probation, citing his age of 67 years, his health, and lack of criminal history. Jackson also sentenced Stone to 2 years of probation after prison time and fined him $20,000. The sentencing set off speculation of when, not if, President Trump would grant Stone a pardon, but Trump, who issued 11 high-profile pardons earlier in the week, said he's holding off for now. VOA's Steve Herman reports.
The president, speaking in Las Vegas to former prison inmates reentering society, said he hopes a judge will agree with him that Stone deserves a new trial because one of the jurors allegedly posted anti-Trump material on social media.
It's my strong opinion that the forewoman of the jury, the woman who was in charge of the jury, is totally tainted.
Trump added, he'll let the process play out for now, but at some point, we'll decide whether to intervene using his presidential clemency powers. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
But even the prospect that Trump might someday pardon Stone prompted a preemptive rebuke Thursday from critics like Democratic House Intelligence Chairman Adam Schiff of California, who tweeted after the sentencing that, quote, to pardon Stone when his crimes were committed to protect Trump would be a breathtaking act of corruption. Trump ally Senator Lindsey Graham tweeted that Trump has all the legal authority in the world to pardon Stone if he so chooses. Joining us to discuss all of it, criminal defense attorney, former CIA officer, also former prosecutor Jack Rice. Jack, before handing down the sentence, Judge Amy Berman Jackson criticized the administration for its handling of the case, calling Barr's intervention unprecedented and Trump's repeated public comments about the case entirely inappropriate. Jackson, however, said she would not be influenced. So, Jack, thanks for joining us. How unusual is it for a judge to excoriate a president like this?
It's extraordinary because we really haven't seen any United States president do what this president is doing in terms of trying to influence the judiciary. And in fact, I look at this on a worldwide basis. I think about the training I've done all over the world where you're trying to train the judiciary and prosecutors and defense attorneys to really stand up and support the rule of law. This absolutely undercuts it because this actually encourages corruption. When you take the executive branch and they reach in and say, hey, I have somebody who's my friend and I want you to treat them differently. That is exactly what the United States has tried to fight. They've been continued to actually try to make those efforts and continue to this day. So to have a sitting president actually doing it before a federal court is nothing short of extraordinary.
The president was live tweeting during the hearing before the actual sentencing came down from the judge and continued to pretty much give a full-throated defense of Roger Stone, saying he's been treated unfairly, he's done really nothing worse than anyone else. And the judge really tried, it seemed, to make it clear where her perspective was on the crimes committed. Does that make a difference? Is it sort of like that's on the record as well if the president does come out and pardon? And does it make a difference if a president who has the right to pardon anyone he wants really seems to be going for pardoning his friends and allies who he believes have been wronged.
I think about it in two different ways. The pardoning of somebody. First of all, the president has the right to pardon literally anybody they want, except for maybe himself, although that issue is still up for the fight, and the president has kind of argued that he has the right to do that. But really, the president has the right to do that. That's a separate question from whether they should or whether it's appropriate. But the part that I find even more disturbing is the effort by a sitting president to try to manipulate the judiciary, to manipulate an ongoing case and how they should treat that case, how they should approach the case, what the standards that should apply to that case. That is actually much, much different than what this president has been trying to do, talking about the fair process or lack thereof, trying to talk about what the jury was doing. He wasn't there. He doesn't understand. And is actually trying to manipulate the court. That is simply something that a sitting president has never done before. And so when we have this happening again and again, even when we have the attorney general at least claiming that he wants the president to stay out of it, he continues to do so, and we watch the degradation of the judiciary as a result. There needs to be independence of the courts. That's something that's fundamental to who we are as a country, and this is absolutely not a left or right question. This is not something that should ever be done by somebody on the left nor somebody on the right, and constitutionally, this is something we have all said would be absolutely beyond the pale, unacceptable, and then to simply sit back and simply say now, oh, that's fine because this president likes to shake things up. Well, if what you're saying is you want to do something fundamentally different than what the Constitution actually requires and what we've stood for multiple hundreds of years, that's a heck of a stretch.
And the prosecutor who replaced these four in presenting the case and who did the investigation, who resigned after the attorney general got involved and changed their recommendation, seemed to back his predecessors. That was sort of in defiance of Attorney General Bill Barr, who felt that the recommendations were lower, but ultimately the judge came back with a pretty low sentence given the recommendations. Why do you think that was?
The original recommendations, and I think that's the rub, because the original recommendations from the feds, and just the prosecutors, was 7 to 9 years. And then what you saw was the president step in and ultimately the attorney general step in and justice step in and then wipe those recommendations away. Now, it's true that the judge in this case had the authority to go up, and they could have gone up. She could have gone up. But ultimately, the question will be, what was the influence of the president on justice to come back and do what it is that they did, which impacted this case? And it's those actions, it's that series of decisions that we simply sit back and say, well, that's the president's right. It's not the president's right. The president has obligations that are bigger and broader than that, and certainly the idea of simply overthrowing an entire approach to what presidents do because he wants to protect his friend is something that this country should not be standing for. It's something that should be seen as unacceptable on all sides, not just if you're opposing the president politically, because it's not a political question.
Well, we shall see. The president wants him completely exonerated. I'm not sure that can happen if he pardons him.
Well, that's true, because technically that means he was still convicted of it. But the proverbial dirty trickster that he is, and that's in fact as he has described himself, Stone, I think from his perspective, that means that you can walk with impunity, or at least I think that's how people could see it.
All right. We appreciate your perspective as always. That's criminal defense attorney, former CIA officer Jack Rice. The World Health Organization on Thursday emphasized the need for all countries with cases of the coronavirus to work with the organization to help contain and eliminate the disease and outlined steps to it's taking to broaden its own efforts. VOA's Julie Tabo has more.
In its Thursday press briefing in Geneva on Thursday, the World Health Organization emphasized the importance of containing and eliminating the coronavirus, which the WHO Director General referred to as public enemy number one.
As of 6 a.m. Geneva time this morning, China has reported 74,675 cases of COVID-19 to WHO, including 2,121 deaths. The data from China continue to show a decline in new confirmed cases. Once again, we are encouraged by this trend, but this is no time for complacency.
Several countries have reported new cases of the virus.
Outside China, there are now 1,076 cases in 26 countries with a total of 7 deaths.
Of all cases outside China, more than half are among passengers on the Diamond Princess cruise ship.
The first passengers have now disembarked, providing they have a negative test, no symptoms, and no contact with a confirmed case in the past 14 days. Japan has also advised passengers to stay at home for a further 14 days and monitor their temperature. And also, Japan has set up a hotline for passengers to call if they have concerns.
In the past 24 hours, the Islamic Republic of Iran has reported 5 cases of the virus, including 2 people who have died. And there are now more than 100 confirmed cases reported in South Korea.
The number of cases in South Korea reported today are actually from several distinct clusters, which the Korean authorities are following very closely. So although the number seems quite high, they are mostly linked to known existing outbreaks.
In addition to monitoring the evolution of the outbreak, the WHO says its main role is to work with countries and partners to coordinate the global response.
As you know, a WHO-led international team of experts is now on the ground in China, working with their Chinese counterparts to find answers to some of the things we don't know, including the transmissibility of the virus and the impact of the measures that China has taken.
The WHO's research and development team is developing drugs for potential treatment.
So at this moment in time, there is no proven effective treatment for COVID-19. And so that is clear at this moment in time. However, there are ongoing clinical trials being done in China at this moment as well.
The Director General said that while the number of cases of COVID-19 outside of China remains small, he cautioned it may not stay that way for long. He urges the international community to work together to control the spread of the virus. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
Former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg was a major target of his Democratic rivals in his first debate Wednesday in Las Vegas, Nevada. Bloomberg has already had an impact on the race by spending hundreds of millions of dollars on TV ads and shot into second place in some national public opinion polls behind Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Bloomberg finds himself in a crowd of moderates all trying to be the main alternative to Sanders, a self-described democratic socialist with strong support from the progressive wing of the party. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
In the latest Democratic debate broadcast by NBC News, former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg walked into the political equivalent of the lion's den.
I'd like to talk about who we're running against, a billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg.
Leading the charge was Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Look, I'll support whoever the Democratic nominee is, but understand this. Democrats take a huge risk if we just substitute one arrogant billionaire for another.
Also eager to pile on Bloomberg was the front runner, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
We are giving a voice to people who are saying we are sick and tired of billionaires like Mr. Bloomberg seeing huge expansions of their wealth while 500,000 people sleep out on the street tonight.
Bloomberg tried to make the case that he could unite Democrats and take on President Trump in November.
I think we have two questions to face tonight. One is, who can beat Donald Trump? And number two, who can do the job if they get into the White House? And I would argue that I am the candidate that can do exactly both of those things.
On the economy, a unique leader, Mike Bloomberg's created over 400,000 jobs.
Bloomberg has spent hundreds of millions of dollars to promote himself as a centrist alternative to Sanders. But his wealth and late entry into the race have also made him a Sanders target.
We are a democracy, not an oligarchy. You're not going to buy this election.
Let me finish, thank you.
Bloomberg's strategy is to exploit the uncertainty in the Democratic race, says analyst Jim Kessler.
His candidacy was really contingent on there being a muddled race. There's a muddled race. So if you look at the chessboard right now, which he has no control over, the pieces on the chessboard have moved in probably the most advantageous way it is for him.
Thank you.
Bloomberg presents himself as a moderate alternative in the Democratic race, but he has plenty of company, says Julie Pace.
Like Joe Biden, Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, who are really looking to break out of that moderate lane, he's actually making that lane much more crowded by getting in the race at this stage.
Having skipped the early contest, Bloomberg is counting on a strong performance in the 14 primaries being held on Super Tuesday, March 3rd, says analyst John Fortier.
He hasn't really faced the scrutiny of the other candidates. I think he might have a place to put his flag on, but we don't know. And so I think the possibility is there because of his money, because of the spending he's done, and yet we don't know that he will stand up to scrutiny of the other candidates.
Bloomberg will continue to bombard the airwaves with ads, but his rivals are sure to raise questions about his viability after a rocky performance in his first debate. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Saudi King Salman discussed security issues presented by Iran Thursday in Riyadh. One day before the meeting, Pompeo told reporters he was ready to negotiate with Iran, but was not in a rush to sit with Iranian officials at the bargaining table.
The Saudi news channel showed U.S. Secretary Pompeo meeting with King Salman along with a delegation of top U.S. officials. Saudi media did not play up a similar meeting later in the day between the secretary and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the focus of continuing U.S. congressional ire over the 2018 killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi at the kingdom's Istanbul consulate. Pompeo reportedly also met with Saudi defense minister Khalid bin Salman. Pompeo visited the strategic Prince Sultan Air Base, where the U.S. has stationed fighter jets and U.S. forces following a defense buildup in the wake of Iranian missile and drone attacks on Saudi oil installations last year. U.S. Patriot missile batteries were also deployed near the base. Commentator Mohammed Saad of the Saudi Daily Okaz told Saudi media, Pompeo's visit shows that both Washington and the West consider Riyadh an important player in countering Iranian expansion in the region. He says Iran has turned the region into a powder keg for the last 40 years due to efforts to export its so-called revolution, spreading conflicts, bloodshed, terrorism, and extremism. He adds that the strategy to counter Iran recently changed after a U.S. drone strike killed top regional commander General Qasem Soleimani, a driving force behind Iran's aggressive policies. Dr. Paul Sullivan, a professor at the U.S. National Defense University, tells VOA the U.S. finding that Iranian missiles were sent to the Houthis and used against Saudi targets is not exactly surprising. Yemen, he says, is a desperately poor and shattered country full of frustrated and angry young men. He added it is fairly easy recruiting territory for Iran and its enablers. The Saudi-led coalition, which has been battling the Houthis since its military intervention in Yemen began in March 2015, has been unable so far to dislodge them from the capital Sana'a and restore exiled President Abdrabu Mansour Hadi as leader of the entire country. Sullivan goes on to stress it is easy for Tehran to pay off smugglers and criminals to move weapons around the region. He argues the dark forces of the weapons trade fit well into Iran's nefarious strategies. Washington-based golf analyst Theodore Karasik tells VOA that Pompeo's visit to both Saudi Arabia and Oman is meant to bring further attention to the issue that Iranian maritime and land smuggling routes remain active, supporting the Houthis. Karasik adds that Pompeo is due to raise the subject with Oman's new Sultan Haitham bin Tariq following the death of Sultan Qaboos and the traditional 40-day mourning period. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Turkish soldiers' deaths are ramping up tensions with Moscow. The World Health Organization warning against complacency as the coronavirus cases appear to decline in China. The U.S. and Taliban deal likely to include communication means to de-conflict potential military incidents. And U.S. sanctions on Iranian officials have been installed for barring candidates. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. U.S. military commanders say the United States will support African governments in their efforts to secure and stabilize their countries. The 8th Africa Land Forces Summit in Ethiopia ended with a call on African troops to improve their human rights record. We get more now from Mohamed Youssef.
This week, top U.S. military commanders met their counterparts in Africa to discuss ways of protecting African countries from violence and instability. In recent years, the threat of terrorist groups like Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab has increased, and criminal networks have become more brazen and prominent. U.S. Army Africa Commanding General Roger Kutia said the continent needs professional armies to combat the armed groups.
In keeping with this week's theme, which is tomorrow's security demands leadership today, we've been focused on the roles African land forces chiefs and their senior enlisted leaders have in developing defense institutions that train capable and professional forces that respect the rule of law and human rights and that contribute to greater security and stability on the African continent.
The annual summit of African land forces was attended by representatives from 42 countries who gathered in Addis Ababa to share their experiences in dealing with violence and the need to cooperate in dealing with emerging threats. The U.S. military's Africa Command currently gives support to about a dozen African countries. In particular, the command has carried out many drone strikes against Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab, which has tried for years to overthrow the internationally recognized government of Somalia. In Washington, the Trump administration has signaled it may scale back U.S. military operations in Africa, a decision that many African security experts see a step back in the fight against terror groups. Kutia assured African military leaders his country was not abandoning them.
The review is focused on making sure that the resources we have in Africa are aligned with our national defense strategy. We also want to make sure that we're efficient with our resources, that we're not duplicating effort, and that whatever we're doing on the African continent is complementary. So the bottom line is the United States is not walking away from Africa. We're committed and we remain engaged.
Some African security forces have been accused of using heavy-handed tactics to combat insecurity, something that has pushed the youth to join violent groups. Analyst Yann St-Pierre, who runs the Berlin-based security firm Mossecon, says African governments need to work on winning over the population.
It's all about the relationship with the local population. And we've seen it in other areas, not only in Africa but around the world, that if the local population has a strained relationship with its guardians, with the military, with the police. That creates a situation where the terrorists that sometimes can provide and the military that they don't really trust.
Pierre says another problem is that African security forces are often dependent on international aid and training. In many ways, he says, that dependency lets outsiders dictate strategy for African forces, which he says is not conducive for very specific needs for an area. Mohamed Youssef for VOA News, Nairobi.
And you're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. Around 20,000 people are expected to attend a public memorial service for basketball legend Kobe Bryant, his daughter Gianna, and his daughter Gianna, which will be held at the Staples Center in Los Angeles, California, at the end of this month. Bryant's fans from all over the world are still mourning his sudden and tragic death, but fans in Los Angeles have a special connection to the L.A.-based player and are visiting some citywide images of the star. Gandhira Pratama reports from Los Angeles.
Murals that depict Kobe Bryant started appearing all over Los Angeles, California, following the legendary basketball player's sudden passing. Many of the works include Kobe's 13-year-old daughter, Gianna, who died with him in a helicopter crash along with seven others. These murals became a place for fans to gather, grieve, and reminisce.
We're here just to, you know, show love for Kobe Bryant and his daughter Gianna, and just wanted to come to L.A. and just show some love and take a picture of Kobe Bryant's mural right here.
One such work can be found in La Brea neighborhood. Created by L.A.-based street artist Thierry Mr. Brain Wasguera, this mural features newspaper articles highlighting Bryant's career accomplishments and some of his iconic and inspiring quotes. This tribute is also unique as it invites fans to make their mark on the artwork by writing messages for their fallen hero.
Because he was also a legend for everyone, not only in the game for basketball, but for everyone in their life. He inspired everyone to push themselves to do their best. So, in my opinion, I really think that having murals of Kobe Bryant and Gigi is honestly, like, something everyone would remember.
He was like an icon, you know, like, real good basketball player, you know, like family man. Did you see how he is with his kids? And he just always had that positive attitude, and just, you know, he was just idolized. He's one of my favorite basketball players growing up, him and Michael Jordan.
Another mural can be found in Melrose outside of Shoe Palace, a popular streetwear store. Here, visitors are encouraged to plaster post-it notes with messages for the Los Angeles Lakers star.
We started, when we heard of the passing, we saw a lot of people started to show up, bring some flowers and some memorabilia, and wanting to put notes. So I took out some notepads, started writing a few, gave my employees and a platform for everybody to want. So we had a bunch of pens, marker, post-it notes so people could leave a mark, remember Kobe, the good moments, the bad moments, what Kobe meant to them.
Mural artist J.C. Rowe, who doesn't want to appear on camera, said that he felt bittersweet as his creation 4 years ago is now more meaningful and important to the community with the basketball legend's passing.
I think it's something special and something unique about the paper being fragile, and that the messages on each note is so meaningful. Like, I feel like maybe we all found out that life is both fragile and meaningful.
Kobe Bryant and his daughter were buried on February 7th in a private ceremony near the family's Southern California home. Gandhira Pratama, VOA News, Los Angeles.
I do my hair toss, check my nails. Baby, how you feeling?
But Lizzo this week at the Brit Awards in London stole the show on the red carpet by wearing a full-length gown styled as a Hershey's chocolate bar wrapper. It was designed by Moschino, a luxury fashion house. His outfits feature a lot of very colorful, fun, pop culture-y type outfits. And it sounds like this could become a trend. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today. You can always find us at voanews.com, and we thank you for listening. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.